switching things up this week to mark the end of summer, running some of our favorite conversations we've had since the show began. Our first interview today is with the fabulous Bob the Drag Queen, followed by a conversation with the one and only Jenny Slate.
The date, September 1st, 2020.
The time, news o'clock. Hey friends, I'm Hayes Brown.
And I'm Casey Rackham. Welcome to BuzzFeed's News O'Clock.
Okay, this week we are revisiting some of our favorite interviews we've done since we started the show earlier this year. So each day this week, we'll be bringing you two of our favorite News O'Clock conversations.
Today's show kicks off with an interview from late July that we did with Bob the Drag Queen, RuPaul's Drag Race Season 8 winner and star of the HBO Max series, We're Here.
Welcome back. You might know her from her stand-up special, Suspiciously Large Woman. You may recognize her as the winner of the 8th season of RuPaul's Drag Race. He stars alongside Drag Race alumna Eureka and Shangela in the HBO series, We're Here.
We're honestly just thrilled to be joined by Bob the Drag Queen. Good afternoon, Bob.
Hi, how are you all?
Great. So on the show, you, Eureka, and Shangela visit small towns mostly in the American South, and you adopt some local first-timers to put on a drag show. You're from Columbus, Georgia. Did any of these towns remind you of home?
Well, to be fair, they're not most. And we do. Well, it also depends on what people consider the South. So we do Twin Falls, Idaho, Branson, Missouri. Mm. I know a lot of Southerners who wouldn't call Branson, Missouri, the South.
But they say Missouri, so I'm pretty sure they're the South.
But we do go to Ruston, Louisiana, and Spartanburg, North Carolina, as well. Anyway, that's not the point. The point is, I don't know if they necessarily reminded me of home because, of course, everyone has these ideas of these small towns, but then there's their small town. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like people who have the ideas of like what a Trump supporter is, but then there's also like, but they're different Trump supporters.
I see you.
Like, oh, but they're different. They're not like your nasty Trump supporting parents. By the way, for the record, my mom did not support Trump. So it doesn't remind me of my own hometown because I see, you know, I have a much more nuanced view of Columbus, Georgia. Mm. Mm.
On the show, there's a lot of fear and judgment in these areas, especially before the drag shows. How does that compare to what you experienced in your journey to drag?
Well, I started drag here in New York City. I'm in Manhattan right now, to those of you listening.
Same, shout out.
Shout out. Where are you in Manhattan?
East Harlem.
East Harlem. I'm in Washington Heights. Well, Casey, we have to ask, where are you?
Oh, I'm in Los Angeles.
Los Angeles. All right. Well, I mean, no one's perfect. I was really surrounded by lots of amazing queer people, specifically in the queer nightlife scene. I really don't even have that many friends who would identify as straight, to be honest, or not queer at least. But also when I came to these towns, I realized that they also had these microcosms of that as well. Like in Twin Falls, there is a vibrant, small, but still a vibrant drag community happening in Twin Falls, Idaho.
So it's not just the drag show in We're Here. There are so many emotional, heartfelt scenes between friends and family members. Some of the people are having confrontations, for instance, about hardship they faced when they came out. Some are having loving conversations about how grateful they are for the support system. Had you ever been part of something like that before with this much like emotion on display and you having to help people process it?
I don't know. A lot of people don't really bear. I mean, well, I will say this. Being a drag race girl, a lot of people do come up to you and bare their souls to you because they feel like you had a hand in their happiness. And I mean, I can acknowledge that maybe I somehow encouraged happiness, but I also like people to take, you know, ownership of their own joy. So yeah, I've had people like tell me intense or intimate things before being on We're Here.
There are also a lot of personal transformations on the show. Were you surprised by any of them, or was there one that just really impacted you the most?
Well, the one that came to me a lot was Tanner in Branson, Missouri, who was struggling with his queer identity and his Christian identity. And he seems to really figure it out. And if you go on his Instagram now, she's as gay as the day is long and also seems a lot happier than he was when I was there. Like, he seems to have really figured himself out.
So shifting gears, your season was actually the first full season of RuPaul's Drag Race that I watched through as it aired, and I was high-key thrilled that you took the crown.
Oh, me too.
Right? Me too. I gotta ask though, what was your favorite dumb purchase that you made after winning the $100,000?
Oh, you know, I'm really not terribly frivolous, so I don't have like a bunch of like silly purchases.
But there's gotta be at least one that's like, all right, I got the cash, I'm throwing it at this. I normally would not, but.
So we were out shopping one day, and I carry a fanny pack a lot. I either carry a purse or I carry a fanny pack every day. And I was buying really cheap fanny packs, like really, really cheap fanny packs.
For the nylon suckers that will fall apart.
Just
like, a week, yeah.
Like $2, like really cheap, really cheap shit. And then I was out shopping with Asia O'Hara and Kim Chi. They're like, you need a designer bag. And I was like, I'm just not that girl. I hear you, but that's not me. Anyway, they convinced me to in one day buy a Burberry fanny pack and a Versace backpack. So those were probably my most ridiculous. This is my fanny pack here that I carry all around a lot.
She's gorgeous,
which I love a lot.
So you're a New York queen where the pandemic hit first and hardest. How's the drag community been coping with quarantine?
The answer is, they've been adapting, but it's not great. I mean, one of our bars just announced today that it is, well, a few of our bars announced they weren't closing. One of our big drag bars announced it is closing its doors forever. There's a bar called Therapy here in New York City that has announced that it will not be reopening after. And that really hit a lot of us. I mean, I used to do shows at Therapy. I worked there for, I think, 3 years. And a lot of my friends worked there, and they hire a lot of drag queens. So I'm starting to wonder, like, how we're going to come out on the other side of this.
Yeah, there's even in LA recently, I'm a queer woman, and one of our places has 2 monthly dance shows that they put on. That's being closed because they can't have that dance space anymore because of coronavirus. And it really impacted so many people emotionally because they didn't realize, and myself included, how much it means to that queer community to have that space.
Especially for queer women, queer men love to party and will do it really often. And in the queer woman space, there's probably tends to be like a party here called Hot Rabbit in New York City that throws like a monthly or bi-monthly dance party. Whereas gay guys are like Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. We dance. And on Sunday we go out, but instead we just do karaoke. Because the girl's got to rest. So I can understand how impactful that could be.
So one of the things that, the drag community has been doing, trying to adapt, has been doing a bunch of videos on Instagram and YouTube.
Yeah,
and I know you've been doing that with some of your fellow former drag racers. And in one of them in particular, you're talking with season 9 runner-up Peppermint, and you bring up a certain article about RuPaul owning property out in Wyoming.
Did you see that article from Instinct magazine?
Oh, the fracking?
No, not that.
Oh.
Yeah, I remember.
So, did you ever get a response from Mr. Charles or World of Wonder about that? Just curious, out of curiosity.
Well, I mean, RuPaul and I don't talk a lot.
Really? You don't chat on the phone often?
And RuPaul's gone like going blank on social media altogether. I mean, I don't know. I don't know what's going on with RuPaul. I know RuPaul deleted his Twitter and all the content from his Instagram. And I mean, I hope everything's going fine. I really hope that he's doing well.
Fair enough. I tried to get you to spill some tea, and instead you took a loving sip of it. And you know what, Bob? That's why you're a queen.
Oh, before we go, I want to quickly talk about something.
Hit me. What do you got?
I'm using my platform to talk about Black Trans Lives Matter as much as possible. So I would like to take just a short moment to discuss the Black Trans Lives Matter movement with you all, if you don't mind.
Yes, definitely.
Well, I've been talking. So me and Peppermint, my Franklin sister, we were basically calling each other and having these long discussions about like being Black and being queer. And she would tell me about being a trans femme. And I would talk to her about being non-binary. And we created this thing called Black Queer Town Hall, which I would love to encourage everyone to go check it out. And I've just been trying to challenge people, especially cis men, especially Black cis straight men, to engage in the Trans Lives Matter discussion. it's been really on my mind a lot lately, because it's one thing to hear me say it, or to hear a Black trans woman say it, or to hear like Lady Gaga say it, but we need to hear like Lil Wayne, Jay-Z. We need to have Waka Flocka Flame, Wiz Khalifa. We need to have, like, we need to have these people who have reach and access to other Black cis straight men talk about the validity of Black trans women.
Right. We need Dwayne Wade to have some company out here.
Yeah, Dwayne Wade is on a lonely island right now, and it's only because he has a trans daughter. And you shouldn't have to be that close to transness to acknowledge that the lives of trans people matter.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean?
I do. How has this message, what's the response you've gotten so far?
Well, I live in a vacuum. So everyone around me is like, girl, work. Of course they matter. Yes, they do. But I'm sure if you step outside of that, it changes a lot. I mean, I got my first taste of that when HBO tweeted out the trailer for We're Here. Because I see things on my side. Everyone's like, work, slay, mama, yes. You know what I mean? But of course, when HBO does not have an exclusively or predominantly queer fan base. So I got a rude awakening. I was like, these people are, but there are people out there who still think like this, and we need to access them, because it is truly a lack of knowledge. You know what I mean? Anyway.
No, it is. And I agree with that. I think now's the time to have our straight allies, and more importantly, our straight advocates being out there to talk about how these issues aren't just issues that queer people should be talking about, you know?
And I want to thank Dwayne Wade and Gabrielle Union. And I'm sure Gabrielle Union has a lot to do with why Dwayne Wade is on the up and up. She really holds people accountable, and I love that about her. And anyway, I just want to say, like, we need more Gabrielle Unions, more Dwayne Wades out there in the world, standing up for not just queer people and their family, but like outside of that as well. Like, imagine if you gave the random person on the street the same care, love, nuance, and, you know, space that you give the people in your family.
Mm. Mm. Definitely.
That is so important. And you know what, Bob, thank you for sharing that with us. And thank you for being with us today. This has been a great conversation.
My pleasure. Thank you. Y'all be well.
It was great to revisit that interview. Since we last spoke to Bob, fellow We're Here co-stars Shangela Laquifa-Wadley and Yurika O'Hara have announced they have plans to take season 2 overseas and make it a truly international show. When we come back, we'll hear from Jenny Slate. So stick around.
Welcome back. For our second interview today, we're talking to actor, comedian, and producer Jenny Slate. We talked to her back in the beginning of July.
Plus, in case you didn't know, her new movie, The Sunlit Night, is now available to stream in the U.S. Please enjoy the interview.
Today's guest is a comedian, actor, and now a producer, too. You might know her from shows like Parks and Recreation and Bob's Burgers, the movies Obvious Child and Zootopia, or internet favorite Marcel the Shell. That's right. It's the one, the only Jenny Slate. Jenny, thank you so much for joining us.
Wow, cool intro.
I mean, you did that, so yeah, congratulations for the intro.
Like the one, the only?
Yes,
I mean,
yes.
Sure, I'll take it.
Are there many Jenny Slates running around Hollywood that we don't know about?
I hope not, because I hope not. But I think there is another Jenny Slate who is a singer. And she very like graciously a long time ago gave me her Twitter handle because she was on it first.
Oh, that was kind.
Yeah, that was really nice. Really, really nice. I still think about that. That was like just a, yeah. So I have Jenny Slate and she has something else now. I don't know why, but it's really generous of her. Yeah.
So congratulations on your debut as a producer on your upcoming film, The Sunlit Night. Did you feel more powerful walking around the streets of Hollywood or at Sundance where the movie premiered last year? Like, oh, excuse me, producer here. You can move aside now.
Gosh, I really wish. That's a true, honest answer. No, I didn't at all. But and there are like many ways that one can be a producer, you know? Our movie was filmed in Arctic Norway, and in general, just to like get the equipment there and figure out how to get a crew to shoot there was a logistical puzzle that really took some genius work of Michael Clark, who produced the movie. And I did not like, you know, figure out how to get a drone into the sky, like, you know, things like that. But it is nice to understand the amount of choice making that goes into making a film. And I think that will stay with me even on movies where I just show up as a performer.
Yeah, definitely. So like you said, the film takes place in Norway, where you actually went to film during the summer. How did you cope with the sun actually never setting there?
It's funny. That's what people usually ask it with that kind of undertone of, did you go crazy? Mm-hmm. But I really like the sunlight, and I usually sleep with the light on. Like if my fiance isn't there, I'm very afraid of the dark.
Oh, okay.
I've said this a million times and, you know, but I grew up in a haunted house and it was haunted, and you might think that's just a scam. But it feels very true for me. And so anyway, I really liked the 24 hours of sunlight. I don't think everyone did, but I
want to ask so many questions about this haunted house, but we lose so much of your time right now.
Yeah.
So your character in the film, Frances, is a painter who heads out to the Arctic to try to make her art better and reconnect with herself. How did you find yourself connecting to her when shooting the movie?
I think Frances's central struggle of like, feeling that the world is acting on her and really not quite understanding what powers she possesses to become active and make decisions about what gets in her path are something that I felt, you know, myself, like, oh gosh, I really feel that the world is powerful. I feel that my ambitions are powerful. I'm not quite sure what my central abilities are yet, and if they even match what my dreams are, and like, therefore, also, are my dreams inappropriate? Are they just not going to come true? Are they just like only fantasies rather than something I'm actually on the path to like get closer towards? And so I'm a very poor visual artist. Like I'm very, very bad. And I've just never been able to be good. And I think that's really weird because I genuinely do kind of like my personal taste. Like I like what I like aesthetically, but if someone were like, cool, make a painting that you would want in your house, I am not able to do that.
Yeah. Very fair.
Yeah.
I mean, same. People who can do that are basically magicians, I feel like. Oh, you took that canvas and made it into art?
I went to one of those paint nights and it didn't go well.
Yeah. No, I'm bad. Yeah.
So, Jenny, you recently made the decision to stop voicing the character of Missy on Big Mouth. And for those who don't know, Missy is a biracial character whose father's Black and mother's white. Can you tell us a little bit about what went into that decision?
Yeah, I can. But, you know, I will say before we speak about it that it's something that needed to happen. It's not about me. While I am not at all like afraid of it or afraid to talk about it, I don't think I should be getting any attention for it. If you view it as a, whatever you view it as, I think it should call attention to the situation at hand, which is one that many white people can immediately sort of like act to change. And so I think I, as a white person, was looking around the world in the last couple of months and thinking, there's something that I genuinely don't understand, and I should understand it. And there can be shame and other feelings that come into that. But those are, at least for me, the impetus to make the change. And so I looked around my life and I could see very clearly where my reasoning was flawed and racist. Which is, I think, a scary word for white people to say, because they can feel like it means like, oh, I'm a bad person, you know, or I'm the same as the person that like drove the car through protesters. It felt to me, it's not enough to be posting or to be protesting. What can I do? And so that's what was up for me.
That's really great to hear, especially since so many people, when they do finally like ask those questions themselves, they stick with the shame part. They get to, I am ashamed of X, and then they stick with that without figuring out, okay, well, how do I fix that?
Yeah. And you know, your shame can so often be someone else's burden. Like, right. it feels so bad to feel shame, obviously, but that can quickly go to like, I'm ashamed, you know, and
please comfort me.
Yeah, totally. Like, you know, if I it's been interesting to me in this time to think about it just in terms of how shame exists for me in my personal relationships, and that like I know enough at this point. If I'm like, ooh, I don't like that. I lost my temper or whatever with my partner. The way to apologize to them and make it better is not to like hang my head and be a wet blanket all week, but to sort of be like, I did that. I see what I did. I don't like that I did it either. I would like to change that I did that, but I can't. So I'll just keep changing going forward and, you know, like making it better. It's an interesting process, and it's not just cultural or external. It's actually really internal and deeply personal.
Mm-hmm. All right. So to shift gears entirely, we have to ask you about another role you used to play, Catherine, from your 2013 web series.
What a delight.
Right? For people out there who have not seen it.
Everyone should watch that. Sorry. Everyone. I know you're going to give me the compliment or whatever, but Catherine is one of the best things I've ever made. It's so good. I love it. Sorry, go ahead.
So if you out there have not seen it yet, it's basically an office comedy made up of like micro episodes, and it leans really heavily into that sort of aesthetic you would see in an after school special in the 80s or 90s, or maybe your corporate training video. The main character, Catherine, is bizarre and hilarious. So Jenny, what was your inspiration for a character like that? And what about the whole bit made it just so funny to you?
I think at that time, it sort of felt like, why are all the mainstream comedies like this sort of eye-rolly, like, everything seemed like a Verizon commercial to me. And it seemed like every joke in comedy was like someone being like, if you don't stop doing that, I'm going to freak out. And then another person being like, you're currently freaking out. You know what I'm like? That sort of just strange exchange where the comedy's super called out. And, I also had been watching a lot of Twin Peaks, and I was trying to say to my partner at the time, there's another zone and I'm sensing it. I don't know how to like describe it, but I'll just act it out for you. And I started to act out, like improvise and act out the very first scene that you see in Catherine. I played both characters, and he was like, oh yeah, I get it. I know what you're talking about. And then we started to write it together. And then he developed the look and directed it and really, really brought it to life. Yeah. So it was a total collaboration also in that sense with Dean Fleischer Camp. Yeah.
Okay. So Jenny, last question for you. Things out there are just really sad and scary and weird. What do you think the role of comedy is right now?
You know, I think comedy is often there to let things that seem strange and other be somehow close and accessible. Sometimes comedy can be there to throw down the thing that feels untouchable. You know, but it is difficult because I think, you know, Donald Trump has really blurred the line between reality and satire, and a lot of things that would have been funny because they're so outrageous have now just occurred in reality. So I think now, you know, comedy sort of functions, at least for me, as a balm and as a sort of flare of hope that it's not inappropriate to still be smiling or try to find that weird underside of stuff. And I think it is what it's always been. It's a comfort. But we have to be really more careful with it than ever, because it's also really powerful.
That is a really strong point. Jenny Slate's movie, The Sunlit Night, will be available to watch in the U.S. on July 17th. Jenny, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, guys. What a fun, fun time.
Since that interview, Netflix has recast the role of Missy with a Black actress. Last week, they announced that the part will be played moving forward by Ayo Edebiri, starting with the penultimate episode of season 4 and throughout all of season 5.
That's it for today. Join us tomorrow for two more awesome classic Music Block conversations with Brian Baumgartner, aka Kevin from The Office, plus a candid conversation with two gym owners on the recent CrossFit fiasco.
Be sure to subscribe to News O'Clock on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you go for your sound stories.
And please take the time to leave us a rating and a review. It helps us figure out what you like about the show versus what you love about the show. And remember to set your alarm so you never miss an episode of News O'Clock.